You're listening to This Way Up, a podcast from the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre. We are a global NGO with research experts in more than 20 countries, pushing for greater human rights accountability in business. Our second series is hosted by Elizabeth Dykstra McCarthy, a former member of the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre Natural Resources team, who is now consulting on climate action and environmental issues around the world. Along with several special guests, she'll delve into the social impact of the transition minerals boom, the pitfalls of futuristic methods of mineral extraction, and the capacity of communities to hold companies accountable for abuse, all in search of answers to the question, what is the true cost of clean energy?
The climate crisis is upon us. With it comes the urgent need to decarbonize and transform our economies from those reliant on fossil fuels to greener, cleaner sources of energy. Governments and companies around the world and droves of concerned citizens are driving this transition forward for the good of the planet, its people, and its creatures. But not all people will benefit equally. As the renewable energy transition accelerates, what will the challenges be? Who might the hidden victims be? And what can we do now to make this transition as just as possible?
It's said that if it isn't grown, it's mined. And our demand for minerals and precious metals that have built
April 25th, 1998. In Aznalcóllar, Andalusia, the dam for the collecting basin breaks. Highly toxic mud, a byproduct of copper production, floods the valley for up to 60 kilometers, threatening to destroy a nature reserve. Cultivation has stopped here ever since. One of Spain's biggest environmental catastrophes happened in a copper mine just a few kilometers upstream.
There's a history of mines going out of business and then not being able to clean up the messes that they've made during the mining process.
Initially, they told us we had to care for the environment and the glaciers, but then we went up in the mountains. They even used dynamite. Now we have to drink water from these containers that the government brings because there are no guarantees that the water is not contaminated.
The trade-off then, where you're sucking that water from mountains, from meadows, from streams, from springs, from the Humboldt River, you're sucking that all to fill those pits, and then you're denying, you know, nature and those other areas, or if you're a farmer, you know, and seeing your well go down as a result, you know, you're denying all that.
Opposition has been strong, sustained and vocal. They worry about toxic effects on air, water and the soil. The company says green technologies will limit damage. One campaigner says that's not enough.
It's like dropping a nuclear bomb on that area. I mean, it's going to be a huge hole and tailings piles 800 feet high.
Water pollution, soil pollution, impacts on agriculture and livestock and fisheries, tailings dam collapses, pollution of oceans and air, destruction of pristine habitats from rainforests to glaciers. The environmental impacts of mining run the whole gamut. The use of natural resources has more than tripled from 1970, resulting in increasingly negative impacts on the environment and human health. 90% of biodiversity loss and water stress are caused by resource extraction and processing. These same activities contribute to about half of global greenhouse gas emissions. That is a quote from a United Nations Environmental Programme report published last year to highlight how best to build resilience following the COVID-19 pandemic. It is an incredible amount, and an amount that is only likely to continue. So much for future resilience. However, the numbers alone don't do it justice. For that, let's paint a picture.
Papua New Guinea and the whole Pacific actually is littered with tragedies around mining, both tragedies from a social and an environmental point of view. The Ok Tedi copper mine, situated in Western Province, up in the highlands of Papua New Guinea, in a fairly inaccessible and remote location.
Speaking is Helen Rosenbaum of the Deep Sea Mining Campaign, an association of NGOs and citizens from Australia, Papua New Guinea and Canada, concerned about the impact on marine and coastal ecosystems and communities. Helen has spent over 25 years working on community and human rights, particularly in Papua New Guinea. In the last episode, we looked at how the Grasberg mine in West Papua, Indonesia, became the crucible for a civil war, and touched briefly on how some of the grievances of the indigenous peoples were around the pollution of their land and water, and the impact this had on their health and livelihoods. This is an old story, for which we will stay on the island of New Guinea, but over the border, in Papua New Guinea, in the villages of the Fly River District.
From the air, the haunting beauty of these mountains in Papua New Guinea convey a message of foreboding, a message of warning. When some of the first white men explored the area, they described it as undoubtedly the end of the world. Yet some 70 years ago, a Dutch army officer gave it the unlikely but prophetic name of the Star Mountains. For on top of a steep and slippery peak called Fubalin lies one of the world's largest deposits of gold and copper. The project is called Octedi.
The Octedi project area is located 18 kilometers east of the border with Irian Jaya in the northwest corner of the Western Province, a large but sparsely populated area of Papua New Guinea. The project centers on Mount Fubalin, in one of the most remote parts of the Star Mountain Range, an area characterized by vertical cliffs
and dense tropical rainforest. Well, I think it assumed, actually, that there are only a bunch of ill-educated, illiterate, primitive peoples out there, and they could basically get away with things in Papua New Guinea that they wouldn't dare to get away with in Australia. So they built this huge copper mine. They had a half-hearted attempt at developing a tailings dam that they never really did the proper engineering studies for. And unsurprisingly, in the high rainfall of about 10 metres a year that area has, that dam failed and spilled into the Octedi River. From that point on, which was very early in the establishment of the mine, they just decided that waste disposal would be throwing the waste directly into the Octedi River, which feeds into the huge Fly River system, which is one of the world's largest river systems. And from the Fly River system flies out into the Gulf of Papua and then circulates round into the Torres Strait.
The ecological consequences from these mining projects thus flow from the indigenous communities of Papua New Guinea southwards to the indigenous communities in Australia. Pollution doesn't tend to stick around in just one place. But to give you a picture of what kind of extent we are talking about at the source, Helen visited the mine itself.
I had the experience several years ago of travelling at the invitation of OTML, Octedi Mining Limited, with a couple of other colleagues from Australia to come and have a look at the mine and for them to try and do some greenwashing. They were looking for an opportunity to show what good management practices they had at the mine site and to try and allay our concerns and therefore the opposition that we were presenting to the mine. We invited some of our Papua New Guinean colleagues along as well. And so there was a group of us travelling by bus from the township of Tabubal, following the course of the Octedi River to look at a tailings dump site some kilometres south of the Octedi mine. It was a huge shock to me to comprehend that this gravel-filled gully that we were travelling alongside was actually the Octedi River that I'd seen photos of many years before as this beautiful, deep, flowing river system with canoes, the villagers paddling from one side to the other and fishing in the river system. What I saw at that time was like an eroded gravel highway and really no water in sight. The tailings waste, which is in fact what I was seeing, has just totally covered the river system.
Access to water is a fundamental human right, and that means both quantity and quality. Blocking an entire river is devastating for communities who need it to drink, to cook, to farm, and to wash. Quality, too, is key. Many of these examples will focus on water pollution, which is one of the core impacts of mining pollution, or at least the one most visible and dramatic, on human livelihoods and health.
Life for the villagers downstream of the Octedi mine has not improved, and in fact it's got a lot worse. They've gone from being a people who could sustain themselves on their food gardens and from the fish they were able to harvest from the fast-flowing and clean Ok-Tedi River to being dependent on tinned fish and rice. They can no longer grow their food gardens along the river because the river bank has been eroded and the tailings and the pollution from the mine waste just extends a couple of hundred kilometres, I think it is now, into the interior and through all the small waterways as well that connect with the major river system.
This is some 40,000 villages along the river basin impacted by this mining operation, and impacted in a variety of ways. Particularly affected are the 4,000 indigenous Ngeram people who have lived on this once pristine habitat since before Westerners first arrived on these shores, and who have only begun to have real contact with the Western world in the 1950s. Nor, of course, is the Ok-Tedi mine the only one polluting the rivers. As well as the Grasberg mine, there is the Panguna copper mine, the Porgera gold mine, and the Ramu nickel mine, which in 2011 sought and won the authority to dump 5 million tons of mine waste annually into the Bazimak Bay of the Bismarck Sea. This isn't even an exhaustive list, and the cumulative effects of all these projects and their toxic waste, from acid rock drainage to riverine and marine disposal, is difficult to comprehend.
So sago palms were a staple there. They can't grow their sago palms anymore. That was their staple carbohydrate. They can't source fish from the river system. They don't even want to wash where there is water in the river system. The Ok-Tedi itself, for the few hundred kilometres that it extends, is no longer really a river at all.
First of all is the access to water and the quality of the water that they drink. Secondly, Helen has described how it impacts agriculture, and finally, how it impacts marine ecosystems too. Papua New Guinea sits just above the northeastern tip of Australia. The waste from the Ok-Tedi mine flows into the Gulf, where the Torres Strait Islands are, and onto the coast of Australia. The Torres Strait Islanders are indigenous Australians who, like the Aboriginal people, are the first human inhabitants of Australia, and possess a deep cultural connection to their land, waterways and environment.
Water for Aboriginal people is crucial for, obviously, survival, but identity and part of language and law.
When I go to ceremony with senior elder men, we're talking about water, we talk about the sun, we talk about grass, we talk about all sorts of things. And that senior elder men say, all these things need water.
Yeah, I was just so thoroughly, totally shocked at what had happened to those people. I believe today you can visit that area and see kids with distended stomachs from malnutrition and protein deficiency, and it's a heartbreak. And when we visited the communities and had discussions with them, they asked totally reasonable questions about what seafood is it safe to eat. Can they eat shellfish and certain fish that their people have been using as a source of food? They were concerned about what kind of effects this might have on the health of their kids. They were seeing fish with different kinds of lesions that they've never seen before from the pollution of the mine.
There wasn't data at the time to assess what kind of impact this was having on marine ecosystems. Some of these impacts we won't see for a very long time. The chronic impacts on biodiversity would play out in terms of longevity, things like fertility and reproductive success. Eventually, some species just might die out. The proof would be extinction. This is an ecological tragedy, but also a danger for the Ngeram, who have relied on this food source for centuries. Nor would the impacts be limited to the surrounding area. Water pollution spreads, and spreads quickly.
In that area of the Torres Strait, where heavy metals from the Ok-Tedi mine are busily getting into seafood eaten by Torres Strait Islanders, and goodness knows how much is getting into the seafood eaten by Papua New Guineans, and of course all the way down the Ok-Tedi and Fly River system. So quite early on in the piece, the damage to the Ok-Tedi River became obvious.
An earlier report that Helen had published, as early as 2005, looked into the impact of this mine waste, mainly copper and zinc, on the marine ecosystems it flowed into, and the humans who consumed it. The bioaccumulation in species regularly consumed by the Torres Strait Islanders, such as crayfish, prawns, dugongs and shellfish, were highly elevated. And in other species, like barramundi, parrotfish and sardines, they found high concentrations of arsenic, cadmium, copper, zinc and selenium. According to the WHO, at these levels, it wouldn't have been safe for the islanders to eat more than one or two crayfish per week. But seafood consumption by Torres Strait Islanders and the coastal communities in the Gulf of Papua are among the highest in the world. So it's impossible to analyze the actual exposure at the same time as acknowledging that their way of life had become increasingly unsafe. She expected the same to be true, or worse, for the communities right by the mine. As this story has unraveled, you might perhaps think that the consequences of the mine and its lack of environmental safety standards for both people and planet did not go unnoticed. And you'd be right, the Ngarim people did bring a court case. But it reached a settlement which would have done little for systemic change.
I remember at the time I was working in my office at the Australian Conservation Foundation, where I'd been based for several years working on the Oktedi issue, and just had this feeling of dread in the pit of my stomach that this was not a good outcome. This was a sum of money that sounded quite large as an aggregate, but for each family along the Oktedi River resulted in very small payments. And in payments that didn't actually compensate for the changes to the river system. The other aspect of the court case went nowhere. The mitigation via construction of a new tailings dam was the ask, and that didn't happen. So until today, that mine just still continues to throw its waste into the river system, using that river system as its waste disposal method.
Between around 1984 and 2013, an estimated 2 billion tons of untreated mining waste has been dumped into the Oktedi River. Around 50,000 people are thought to have been significantly affected along the Oktedi River and Fly River systems. The chair of the mining watchdog, the Mineral Policy Institute, once called it one of the worst environmental disasters in the history of mining. Experts now estimate that it could take up to 300 years to clean up the affected areas. Yet, the Oktedi story is by no means unique. Just as we touched on before, these are not issues which are concentrated in one region or in one commodity. In fact, this broader story, mining operations impacting local ecosystems, particularly water access and water quality, leading to loss of livelihoods and degraded human health, has been told dozens of times over. And those are just the ones we know about.
Many areas across Indonesia suffer from lack of clean water. Just 4 years ago, the people of Jamburea village in West Java had to travel far and often to get enough water for their daily needs. Bongas, an urban area, suffers from poor water quality, so poor that drinking it may get you sick.
Mining sites pollute the air and contribute to global warming, and extracting the resource requires as much as 500,000 gallons of water per ton of lithium. In Chile and Argentina, water shortages already exist in many mining areas, and local communities worry that extraction will eventually run the region completely dry. Beyond pollution and drought, no one is certain what the long-term effects of lithium mining will be.
He belongs to the Koya indigenous community that lives in the northern province of Jujuy.
It worries us that they want to start lithium exploration here, but we won't allow that to happen. We will resist. The salt flats are our life. We survive from the salt we sell.
Water is probably the number one issue when you're talking about transition minerals and climate change and addressing climate impacts from a community level.
Jesse Cato, manager of the Natural Resources Program at the Business and Human Rights Resource Center, led the Transition Mineral Tracker project, which collected and analyzed allegations, like the Oktedi mine story, on human rights abuses against companies mining for transition minerals, such as copper, cobalt, zinc, nickel, lithium, and manganese.
A lot of the minerals needed for the transition, like lithium and copper, are significantly water intensive to produce. And they are quite often found in communities and countries like Australia or the Andes region of South America that are already water-stressed countries, so countries that go through naturally periods of significant drought. Where those countries and communities are seeing climate effects now, and we know that countries and communities are seeing climate impacts now, it's not an existential threat that's approaching, it is something that is occurring right now, there is obviously going to be tension and conflict around access to that water and who has the right to that water.
According to the Transition Mineral Tracker, almost 40% of these allegations related to water, and these are communities who are more reliant on their water usage and more vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. This makes it even more important to improve their resilience, not to weaken it.
And so I think the tension point we're seeing in terms of communities being able to make themselves climate resilient is again that push and pull between what are the technologies we need for that, but at a really local level, who is paying the price for those technologies?
Jesse had previously talked about pressure points, the way in which the communities most vulnerable to the impacts of climate change are the ones most impacted by the development of renewable energy technologies in the environments, and the ones who benefit the least. This has already led to a history of asymmetric power negotiations and marginalized communities feeling left, manipulated or abused, and a history of degraded ecosystems for the people who rely on them the most, like those in West Papua, Papua New Guinea and the Torres Strait Islanders of Australia.
Extraction can bring huge economic benefits, but environmental costs are not always built into a country's policies around responsibilities or requirements for companies to meet. And so I think there is a relationship between the two different stakeholders there in terms of both being able to meet the responsibilities, but certainly governments being able to set standards.
As we explored from sub-Saharan Africa to East Asia, this often comes down to a government's relationship with the private sector, particularly, though not always, large transnational companies, and whether a government sets standards and enforces them.
I feel like some companies feel like when they move into certain regions that there is not an understanding of how businesses and companies operate, which is false. Communities know when companies come in with really low human rights due diligence, with really low governance, that is not how they would roll into Australia or Canada and operate. And that's not just because of the different governance requirements. It is absolutely an attitude that certain countries and spaces are more acceptable and open for a different level of exploitation than other spaces aren't. And companies very much abuse and take advantage of that. That is why it is our responsibility to hold those companies accountable at the global level, because those global governance regulations must be mainstreamed and moved down through all of their subsidiaries, wherever they're operating. It's not acceptable to say that you operate within a country's domestic laws when you know those laws would not be to the level of other countries where you operate, and that you are able to abuse or violate different communities, environmental aspects, governance or tax aspects, just because the space is there for you to do so.
For the people affected by the Octeti pollution, there seems little justice. As Jesse outlined, there are global issues at play. A country's ability to assess and police environmental costs, its attitude towards extraction, and an appreciation of the natural world and its natural capital, both as its own good and a resource for humans. But the world and the conversations around community rights is still evolving. The mine was scheduled to close in 2013, but its life has since been extended. More recent stories suggest a glimmer of hope in changing attitudes and laws around environmental abuses like these. For that, let us turn to one of Jesse's colleagues. Manson Gwanyanya is an Africa regional researcher for the Business and Human Rights Resource Center and has previously worked on projects like this. Closely following all extractive projects, he too is concerned about the trajectory these human rights abuses are on.
Certainly with the move to this green energy, there's going to be a very, very, very huge demand in a lot of these minerals.
As we have seen, it's a concern that makes sense. To give another example, in their last Transition Mineral Tracker, the Business and Human Rights Resource Center recorded dozens of environmental impacts from the mining of transition minerals in Africa. At a massive nickel and cobalt mine in Madagascar, there had long been concerns, from both residents and outside experts, that air and water pollution from the mine was causing health problems. In 2018, a cyclone swept through the seaport where the mine, Ambatovi, is based, leaving a trail of destruction and even greater fears of toxic waste leakages. In the weeks that followed, a litany of health complaints ensued, from a flu outbreak to gastrointestinal problems, eye illnesses, and diarrhea in children. Ambatovi officials have, of course, denied that these can be linked to mining operations, but in its own environmental and social impact assessment, it had warned of the potential for impacts on water quality and quantity, and on the people in the surrounding area.
This is where you see health impacts, where the mining companies emit hazardous materials into the environment, which might include polluting water, and the land, and so forth. So during that process, we also have a lot of human rights violations that take place. Some would also include labor rights.
Copper mining is Zambia's most important economic sector.
Mining companies are very powerful, and environmental concerns are extremely difficult to address.
These residents are among hundreds of people who are faced with serious challenges in accessing clean water supply and sanitation. The majority of these residents are poor, and apart from failing to meet their daily food baskets,
copper smelters release emissions. These can cause acid rain, soil erosion, and crop damage. Tests have shown highly elevated concentrations of dissolved copper and cobalt in the Kafue River. Pollution extends to food as well.
Kotundo is located in Zambia's copper mining belt. The slag heaps from the mines begin right on the edge of town. Dust and poisonous fumes are making people sick.
What we mainly fear are chest problems. We also have people bleeding from their noses, especially children. Many have irritated eyes and some have a rash.
So let's take a deep dive into one of those examples, to Konkola Copper Mines in Zambia.
Mining giant Vedanta Resources has agreed to settle claims by Zambian villagers. The villagers filed a claim in London in 2015 against Konkola Copper Mines, alleging that effluent from its Nchanga copper mine was responsible for polluting water sources and land. The claimants, which included 643 children, say the toxic discharge affected the health of communities neighboring the mine, as well as farming and fishing activities. Vedanta did not admit liability. The financial details of the settlement were not disclosed.
Konkola Copper Mines is a subsidiary of a much larger transnational, Vedanta Resources, who took over in 2004. Since then, in 2015, a whistleblower disclosed to the BBC that corners had been cut to save the costs of running operations. As a result, the communities, those who live around Hipapool, Kokosa, Shimulala and Helen, say that the streams which feed their communities, wells and farms, have become rivers of acid. The BBC reporter herself described how she could taste the pollution in the water, and documents later leaked to the BBC appeared to show that KCM had been spilling sulfuric acid and other toxic chemicals into the water sources.
When Konkola Mining started mining in that area, a lot of water or spillages were happening, and they did not do anything to ensure that those water or acidic, the chemicals that are used in mining, what would happen is that as a result of these chemicals spilling into the environment, a number of things happened. The first one was water pollution. So you'd find that a lot of livelihoods were impacted because the communities could not then drink the water as a result of those chemicals that would pour into the water.
There are knock-on effects to water pollution. First is the water we directly consume through drinking and eating. Secondly, the water we bathe and wash in. And finally, the water which goes to our crops and livestock. Each has its own impact. Individually, each can be dangerous, but cumulatively disastrous.
We also had communities complaining that they used to get maybe 10 hectares of maize feed every harvest. That substantially reduced as a result of the pollution that was caused by KCM. At the beginning, the community, I think there were about 1,500 members who were complaining about these things, but the numbers grew as the information got out there.
Through soil pollution, previously fertile land, which sustained a subsistence farming community, can be decimated, either through poorer quality produce or simply no produce at all. Around the Konkola copper mine site, this meant cassava plants a quarter of their previous height, or dying, or simply not growing at all.
The communities realized this when they were farming, that there's something wrong with this water, there's now something wrong with the air that we are breathing, and so forth.
These cumulative effects are hard to measure, and even if it were possible to draw a causal chain, villagers around Chingola didn't have access to that kind of scientific research. The water, discoloured, cloudy, sludgy, and even sometimes orange, was being consumed. People reported that their skin itched if they used clothes washed in the water. Villagers suffered from paralysis and stomach pain and higher mortality rates, particularly among infants.
And they took KCM to court saying that you're putting our lives at risk with all these environmental chemicals that you are emitting into the environment. Naturally, KCM fought that. But in the Zambian High Court, I think they got some form of relief, It was a very minimal amount.
1,826 Zambian villages were involved in bringing this case to court. It is impressive at all that these Chingola communities were able to take Vedanta to court, but the outcome in a local national court is fairly predictable. $1.4 million to 2,000 residents of Chingola. As Manson describes, it was a fairly paltry settlement before. Instead, the villagers brought the case to London, where Vedanta was headquartered. This might seem like arcane lingual finagling, but the fact that the case was heard in the UK was a landmark decision. In fact, one of the reasons the British Supreme Court determined that the case must be heard in the UK was the problem of access to justice in Zambia. There, it might be much easier for Konkola copper mines to get away, as they did, with very little change. In London, however, the lions were at the gate.
This British Supreme Court then allowed for the claimants to sue, being the British, which is then when things got a bit interesting, because KCM then became more willing to negotiate.
Much more willing to negotiate, indeed. By the time it reached the UK, more than 2,500 villages were now involved. The settlement is undisclosed, so it is unclear how much each of these villages or their communities at large would have received. The settlement also allows Vedanta to close the case without admitting liability. Nonetheless, this is, comparatively, a success. But as Manson points out, it is only one part of the puzzle. Necessary, but insufficient.
I think that's also largely part of what the Zambian government needs to do. There are two sides to this. The community saying, I've lost livelihoods to the value of 100,000, pay me. But also the state stepping in and saying, this should not happen again. What you need to do is to take 1, 2, 3, 4 steps. And as far as I'm aware, that has not happened. Looking to ensure that, as far as the environment is concerned, there is some form of remedial action that is taking place.
Like Jesse, Manson is emphasizing the need for government enforcement alongside corporate social responsibility. In this case, there is both bad news and good. The bad news is that this isn't the first time that Konkola Copper Mines has been taken to court. According to The Guardian, a Zambian court had previously ordered KCM to pay approximately $1.5 million in compensation to 2,000 people who became seriously ill after consuming water polluted by a ruptured tailing pipe that had leaked highly acidic effluent into the Mushishima stream in 2006. There's a track record for this, which hasn't led to any change in policy or behaviour. In fact, 2 years ago, the Zambian News reported that 200 secondary school pupils and 43 minors were admitted to hospital after being choked by a cocktail of unknown gases emitted from an acid plant at the mine. Secondly, the company appealed the decision and the settlement was reduced to virtually nothing. These trends make it hard to believe that much will change, so I asked Manson why he thought these issues were so prevalent.
For me, the one part is really, I think, largely to do with racism. These companies would not do this in other European countries. They view black bodies as objects which can be used and they really just don't care. I just reading that these people don't care about black people. Secondly, I think also our governments are to blame because they have let this happen in the name of foreign direct investment.
Manson is, of course, speaking from his personal experience rather than a formal organizational position, but the belief is not uncommon. And given the disparity between company actions in different locations, it's understandable. Government oversight is critical. As Jesse commented in the opening of this episode, when companies enter certain regions, largely in developing countries in the global south, there is a different set of operating standards to when they enter the developed world, countries like Australia and Canada. In order to prevent that, the government of these countries has to enforce its own standards.
There are people who live in these communities. We have absolutely not benefited in any single way from mining that happens in their areas. They have not received a single dollar from anything that happens there.
In 2017, the Zambian Environmental Agency found that the emissions from the mine were more than 10 times the legal limit. The agency ordered Konkola Copper Mines to complete its water recycling operations to prevent the continued water pollution, especially since there were still high levels of sulfates found in the water, despite the past and ongoing court cases. It made further demands, halting the dumping of tailings waste, restoring the flow of several streams, removing silt and waste from several others, and submitting plans for the continuous compliance with these strictures.
In the Environmental Management Act, we do have a number of what is referred to as environmental orders for a facility that is not meeting standards. Basically, orders to help clean the environment. We've seen historical issues or liabilities from mining. I mean, the obvious is on the copper belt. The government has had to spend a lot of money dealing with liabilities from.
It's a good sign for the people around Chingola and their hard-fought campaign. Whether or not it will be enforced is another question.
In a lot of these countries that these violations happen, whether we are mining renewable energy sources or we are just mining coal, gold, or diamonds, the majority of cases, the laws are there. It's only an issue of implementation. So, for example, South Africa does not say, or Zambia, Konkola Mining does not have a law that says as long as you are paying taxes to the government, then you must pollute as much environment as you want. There's certainly no law that says that. There are actually laws that prohibit that. But the issue that we have, particularly in Africa, is that implementation of that laws is the issue. But the issue is that companies, because they know that they are likely to get away with it and there's no implementation or follow-up, or that there's corruption and the political leaders will benefit, they then forego those laws. They will ignore them, which then results in human rights violations.
And of course, what has happened historically in extractives for commodities like copper, so critical to the renewable energy transition, is likely to either continue or escalate. Unless, of course, companies and governments are brought to order by civil society. This is the kind of work that Manson and Jesse and their colleagues work on, alongside civil society organizations and grassroots organizations in every region of the world.
It's understandable in a sense that civil society organizations, when they hear renewable energy, they think, oh, that's something good, let's support that. But they also forget that there is still some extraction that has to happen for that renewable energy to also be successful. So our key focus at the Resource Center is sure that the extraction process, and not necessarily the extraction, but also even the transition from a coal mine to something else, or the closure of a coal mine, happens in a manner that respects human rights. So there are really a lot other nuances that must be taken into account when it comes to renewable energy. But we certainly think there will be an increase in human rights violations, because by the mere fact that extraction itself is violent in its nature. So in order for you to extract the copper or the zinc and so forth, mining has to take place. And we believe that there is very huge potential of human rights violations to happen.
As we have seen, from Africa to Australia, Zambia to the Pacific Islands, these huge potentials have been realized. In the past, these have focused on commodities like copper, which have been historically valuable, but all signs point towards these abuses escalating in other commodities, such as water scarcity in the Atacama Desert due to lithium mining. Progress is coming. The story we told of Oktedi in the early 2000s is not the same as the one told for Konkola copper mines only a few years ago. There is hope that decisions like that of the British Supreme Court will open the gates for multinational companies to be held accountable for the abuses committed abroad.
Je crois profondément que l'état de droit n'a pas à se rétracter.
Ugandan farmer Margaret Kagoli says she is still fighting for compensation for land that was taken a decade ago for tapping the country's oil wealth.
This is the first case under a new French law, which requires large corporations to make sure proper care and attention is paid to the local population and environment.
In 2017, France passed a law au devoir de vigilance, which required large French companies to ensure that their global subsidiaries also complied with French laws around environmental and human rights protection. Between 2019 and 2021, 4 such cases have been filed by NGOs for failing to comply with regulations around oil extraction in Uganda, or wind power in indigenous territories in Mexico, or deforestation and land grabs in the Amazon. This has wider impacts for action on the climate crisis as a whole. In January 2020, several French NGOs and local authorities filed a lawsuit against oil company Total in France based on this duty of vigilance law, in an attempt to force the company to dramatically reduce its greenhouse gas emissions. But for every step forward, there's another step back. More recently, in late November 2020, the Swiss went to the ballot box to vote on just such an initiative, to impose due diligence rules on Swiss subsidiaries with the full weight of Swiss law. It failed, but narrowly. As those who work in these spaces might feel, progress is coming, but inch by inch. Worryingly, inch by inch is not the pace needed for the people on the front lines. There is a clear demand for minerals to power the renewable energy technologies of the energy transition and to tackle the consequences of climate change. It is also clear that they come at a cost. What can we do to mitigate those impacts? Will private companies and governments take the actions necessary? These are the questions so critical to answer for these communities on the front line. What those minerals are and how much they are needed, and in what quantities, varies wildly between different estimations. Given how much uncertainty there is around what the energy transition will even look like, from which technologies will be used, in what quantities, and how much they will evolve from today, nor can these studies incorporate the need for a general reduction of energy consumption. Modal shifts, which might require less transport altogether, cannot be factored into considerations around how many electric vehicles or hydrogen planes might be required. These are the questions we'll be exploring next, whether we can change our approach to extractive economies.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the episode. To stay up to date with all the latest news from us, you can follow us on Twitter at BHRRC or search for Business and Human Rights Resource Centre on LinkedIn. Be sure to subscribe to This Way Up wherever you get your podcasts. Keep tuning in, and if you like what you hear, share with your networks.